Welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm Lauren Williams, one of six consultants who can help you figure out the best plan for your student loans in just 60 minutes. Our fearless leader, Travis, is off on the road. The consultants are stepping in. I actually have a podcast of my own, so this is an exciting little task for me. Today, you're just going to get me. But before we get started with the topic that I want to cover, I want to tell you a little bit about me. I know not everyone has been binge listening to the podcast and heard me before. So here's the long story short. I'm born in Pennsylvania, raised between Pittsburgh and Detroit because my parents split up when I was three. And I always like to point out that I was split between the two places because my parents, you know, shared custody of me, not because of any court order. And I really appreciate the way that they work together despite not being right for one another. So I claim both Pittsburgh and Detroit and had a really good childhood growing up in both places. Another cool thing my parents did was instill the importance of education in me. So after high school, I went off to the University of Miami and I majored in finance. However, life took a little bit of a turn when my junior year of college, I won the NCAA National Championships in track and field. Not only did I win the national championships, I know, give me a high five. Yep. I ran the second fastest time in the world, and that was in 2004, which just happened to be an Olympic year. I spent the next 10 years as a professional athlete, even though earlier in that year, if you would have asked me what I would have been up to even a year or two from now, I would have told you working somewhere after having graduated from school. So I ended up going to four Olympic Games, earning three Olympic medals. And you're probably asking yourself at this point, you should be filthy rich. Why are you a financial planner? Like, this story is not going well. How did you get on this podcast? As with so many things in life, perception is not reality. Olympic athletes have earnings that are all over the place. And the vast majority of us have multiple jobs while training at a chance to win that Olympic medal. Now, I will say that that was not 100% my story. I earned well during my professional career, but not well enough to never work again. So we're not talking NFL or NBA or NHL, MLB kind of money, but I did make a good six-figure living for the entirety of my career. Now, if you're an avid listener of the podcast, you know that we talk a lot about personal finance in addition to student loans, and that financial freedom is not dependent on what you earn, but instead on what you save versus what you spend. Why is this relevant? Because I had 10 years of six-figure earnings, and people are still saying, Lauren, you should be in a great financial situation. Well, tons of people listening here are a part of the FIRE movement, know a lot about saving, putting money away, but the average person doesn't really get to save in the way that they want to if they don't have proper literacy. And that was the case for me. That was how I found my way to the financial industry. I was feeling pretty overwhelmed by not understanding what I was or what I should be doing with my money. And after hiring a few different people that didn't really give me any advice on how I could do better, I decided I needed to figure this out for myself. That's some of the long story short. So the next thing you're probably wondering if you're just getting to know me is why student loans? One of the very first clients that came to me had over $350,000 of student loan debt and made about $130,000 of income. For so many young professionals, hitting that six-figure milestone is a big deal. But now that I've been in this industry for a while, I'm finding that many are also disenchanted. When you check the six-figure box, but you don't actually have the financial stability that you thought you would. I have a single young lady in a low cost of living city that should have been okay, but on a monthly basis, those student loan payments were kicking her butt. I didn't know about the income-driven repayment plans. I didn't know what taxable forgiveness was. I went off to do some research to learn more because while I'd like to think that they teach us everything we need to know in certified financial planning certification or via my finance degree or via the master's degree in business that I have, the truth is that student loans is something that's kind of elusive to everyone and not highly covered in the various types of financial education that exists. So I found a lady named Heather Jarvis, a very respected student loans lawyer in this space. I learned a lot from her mentorship. And eventually I found Travis when I had him as a guest on my podcast. And shall we say the rest is history. I started working with Student Loan Planner in October of 2018. And to date, I have consulted on over $160 million of student loan debt and saved the people that I've worked with, 784 people to be exact, $36 million. That is my story in a nutshell. And I hope you all don't feel like I'm oversharing, but I think it's important to know that there's a real person on the other side of your consultation. Most of the clients I work with are wonderful. I think sometimes people see this as very transactional because we charge a one-time fee for a 60-minute consultation. And I just want to say that couldn't be further from the truth in the way that I feel about the work that I'm doing. My passion is born from the culmination of things that I've encountered during my life. That is a little bit about me. Now let's get to the show topic, because there is, in fact, a show topic. I thought it would be great to do frequent fails and FAQs today. One of the most prevalent FAQs that we get is, will you help me with other stuff, either prior to the consultation or during a consultation? And sometimes even after the consultation, people say, well, what about all these other financial topics that you brought up? How do we get help? The good news is that everyone at Student Loan Planner has some sort of financial expertise. So we are either certified financial planners, certified student loan professionals, we are certified financial analysts. You name it. Some of us carry all three, two of the three. We are highly qualified to be giving financial advice, but where we're focusing our area of expertise in these moments or in those consultations is on student loans. But it's our nature to share what we know and provide value above and beyond the student loan analysis, because after all, we know that finances are intertwined, all aspects of them. However, we are a little bit limited as we are not a full-service financial planning company. One thing to note is that each consultant does have their own business, whether they're doing financial coaching or financial planning and investment management. So if you love the consultant that you work with, you do have the opportunity to engage with us further. Now, those of you who listen all the time are probably wondering, like, hey, why didn't my consultant tell me that? You probably won't learn that most of us have our own business because we're not here to push additional services on you. When we get on that 60-minute call, we are trying to provide the highest value financial advice that we can in that 60 minutes, with the focus being on student loans, not on the other aspects of your finances. But we always give out as many nuggets as we can. So to get to the topic today, I thought it would be cool to provide some of that general information on some of those frequently asked questions that we encounter all the time during our consultations or either in as part of the follow-up questions to the consultations. I always got to put the disclaimer in that this is generic information meant to point you in the right direction to make you aware of the areas that you may need to improve or optimize your finances. So we're giving you some nuggets so that you can go seek out additional information, do some additional research, get a professional that can dive into the details of your specific situation, and then you can implement. Let's dive in. First, I want to start with these frequent fails. So what I'm describing as a frequent fail are these things that I'm seeing often, and I'm going to keep shouting from the rooftop, and especially this first one between now and September, every time you hear me on the podcast, because so many people are making this mistake. We are in the midst of COVID forbearance as it pertains to the pandemic and federal student loans. So if you have federal student loans held by a federal servicer, your loans have been on 0% interest, and you have not been required to make payments since March 13th of 2020. I recently did a consultation where a borrower was paying on her loans and was qualified for public service loan forgiveness. This is the frequent fail. When you are going for forgiveness, whether that's public service loan forgiveness or what we call taxable forgiveness over a period of 20 or 25 years, you do not want to pay one penny extra toward your loans. That is the equivalent of throwing money into a black hole. The balance is going to be forgiven one way or the other. Whether it's a big balance forgiven or a small balance forgiven, there's going to be some forgiveness at the end of it. So if I have dollars to put towards something, I want to be putting that toward my retirement, toward maybe saving for a home down payment. Some people are all keen on the Roth IRA. You might have children who you don't want to have student loans and 529 plans. Maybe you have credit card debt that you need to tackle. This is a great time to be doing that. Building your emergency fund. There's lots of other places to put those funds other than paying on this debt if you are qualified for some sort of forgiveness. And I applaud you. I know that people want to pay on their debt and that sometimes people without debt are pointing fingers at you saying, you need to figure this out. You need to do the most responsible thing. And so you feel this pressure, but don't be pressured by society and narratives. You have to make a decision that's going to be based on information that's relevant to your specific situation and your goals. The action item, if you are one of the people that has done this frequent fail, and like I said, I've done a lot of consultations recently where people are doing this, you can get every dollar you've paid since March 13th of 2020 until present and all the way up through September back. call your servicer and say, hey, I'm sorry. I didn't plan on, didn't know I shouldn't be making payments. I'd love to have a refund. And you can get that money back into your account 7 to 10 business days. That is not something that's normal. So you generally don't pay a bill and then say, never mind, I don't want to pay this bill. I want to pay a different bill. But this is specific to the COVID forbearance. And I highly recommend taking advantage of it if you did not realize that you're going for taxable forgiveness and you've kind of been throwing money into a black hole. The second frequent fail has to do with recertifying if you're on an income-driven repayment plan. One of the things I've seen a lot of is forbearance briefly, 1 month forbearance, and then right back into repayment. When I see it every single year around the same time, that's a clue to me that either the borrower is not recertifying their income on time or that the servicer is not doing their job well and maybe is automatically putting you into an administrative forbearance while they process your recertification paperwork. Why is this a problem? Because when you go into forbearance, your interest capitalizes. What does interest capitalizing mean? That means that you have, let's say as an example, $100 of interest that is piling up on you every month. So at the end of the year, your student loan balance is $1,200 bigger because you're not paying on the loans enough to pay down that interest or to tap into the principal. Well, that $1,200 sits in a separate bucket. Whatever your principal balance was will stay your principal balance, and your interest will, while it is piling up, it's piling up separately. If you have a qualifying event, such as not recertifying your income on time, that is going to cause that $1,200 to dump over into your principal bucket. And now when they charge you interest, your interest is also your principal and you're paying interest on your interest. So you don't want that to pile up on you. The way to check this is look at the history of your student loan. So when we do a consultation, we ask for your .txt file, and it's kind of like your credit report for student loans, if you will, where you can find all this information. So you want to make sure that the servicer that you're working with is not putting you in forbearances unbeknownst to you. If they are doing that, then you call them out and you tell them, you know, uncapitalized my interest. I turned in my paperwork on time. I didn't ask for this forbearance, and I want you to get this interest back out of that bucket. Well, back out of the principal bucket and over in its own separate bucket. Like I said, on your side as the borrower, it is your responsibility to recertify on time. Otherwise, that will cause your interest to capitalize. That is frequent fail number two that I'm seeing. Make sure you stay on top of your certification. Let's get to some of the FAQs. This is going to be so fun. The first one is, my employer does not match. Should I still contribute? I get this one all the time, and it's frequently from doctors that are in residency. In fact, I'm going to read you a question that I got from someone recently. It says, quick question for you. Since we briefly discussed 403b plans versus the Roth IRA contributions, I looked into my employer benefits and they will not match residence contributions, only attendings. Do you still advise contributing to this plan without the match, or should I prioritize the Roth or just putting money into a savings account so it's more accessible if I need it? So let's kind of break this down. This is not just specific to doctors in residency. While it happens to them frequently, you go to a place, and in this particular situation, a 403B is similar to a 401K plan where you're putting money away on a pre-tax basis. This particular person, I suggested prioritizing this 403B because you're putting money away, lowering your adjusted gross income, because they were qualified for public service loan forgiveness. Once again, if we're going to get forgiveness, we want to pay as little as humanly possible toward our loans. One of the ways to pay little on the loans is to lower our adjusted gross income by putting money away for ourselves and our own retirement. Point number one would be, we all want to retire someday. The only way for us to get to retirement is to have funds to retire with. Whether or not your employer is putting money into your 401k or your 403b, just because they're not offering any matching dollars does not mean that it's not worthwhile to contribute. Ultimately, we are responsible for getting ourselves to retirement. And even if they have a 3 or a 6% match, which are two pretty standard numbers, that's not going to be enough to get us there. We're going to have to increase above and beyond that if we want to get to retirement. As an example, for those that are looking for benchmark numbers, generally you should be saving about 20% of your income if you want to be on track for retirement. That's a good litmus test as you kind of check your budget. Now, the thing that was said as well was, what about Roth IRA contributions? You know, 403B or 401K versus the Roth IRA. Roths are all the rage right now. And many are doing it simply because a friend or a family member said to do it. So they're just getting into it. They don't know exactly how a Roth works. So the first thing I want to do is explain the Roth IRA. A Roth is a retirement account where you pay taxes on money that you've earned, and then you use that money and put it into a retirement account called a Roth IRA. When you get to retirement, all of those withdrawals that you're going to take in the future are tax-free. So it's great. Like, hooray, I don't have to pay taxes. Now, the amount that you can contribute changes periodically. And in 2020, the contribution limit is $6,000 a year, unless you are over the age of 50, in which case you can deposit $7,000 a year. Now, what's cool about the Roth, in addition to the fact that you are going to be able to take the money out and not pay any additional taxes on it in the future, is that you can set one up just about anywhere. It's super duper easy. But there's also the consideration of, what are you going to invest in when you set it up? Why do I like the 403Bs and the 401Ks? Because you're going to have a limited amount of investment options. You're not going to need to be a guru. You're going to need to pick something, kind of set it and forget it, because they're already going to limit you with your 401k and what is available to you. So you're putting money away on a pre-tax basis, which, like I said, is great if you're in a situation where you're going for taxable forgiveness or public service loan forgiveness. But also, you don't have to really do a lot of thinking. Now, if you really want to learn about investing, Travis has an investing course that is great for beginners. And if you're not interested in learning about it at all, but you're still set on doing the Roth, then you can use a robo-advisor. Or, of course, there's always the option of hiring a professional. And we always recommend that it's a three-pronged professional: fiduciary, certified financial planner, and fee only. We're not going down that rabbit hole, though. Right now, we're talking about Roths. So a little bit more about the reason behind why everyone is loving on the Roth that does understand how it works is that they think that they will be in a higher tax bracket when they are retired, or they're just unsure of what the government's going to do, which, you know, none of us can tell the future for sure, that the tax brackets are just going to be so much higher when you hit retirement. So they're like, I'd rather just pay taxes on this money now and not pay taxes on it later, not have to worry about paying money on that taxes later. Now, there's strategies and there's things you got to think about as it relates to that. Let's say we get to retirement and you only need to pull out $50,000 a year. And during your life, you've been making $100,000 a year. So I'm randomly making these numbers up. But now you're pulling out at $50,000. You're going to be in a lower tax bracket than you were when you were making that $100,000 a year. So there is a chance that you can hit retirement and be in a lower tax bracket because you don't need as much. Maybe you don't have that mortgage to pay off anymore. You don't have the expenses of the children. Other expenses have gone down, and therefore you don't need as much as what you were earning. And of course, some of your earnings you should be saving. So that's something to consider. But the big thing about the Roth is that we're not going to have to pay taxes later, and whether or not that's going to be best for you based on whatever your personal situation is. Like I said, I'm not a Roth hater. I just want people to know and understand how it works, and then especially as it pertains to student loans and why it may be the thing that you don't want to prioritize. I mean, the most ideal scenario, if we really think about it, is to be able to fund all three buckets as it pertains to investments. And when I say three, that's the pre-tax bucket where the 403Bs, 401Ks, SEP IRAs, all those things live. The Roth bucket, which is that after-tax money we just talked about. And then also the brokerage bucket. And why is the brokerage bucket important? Well, it's important for two reasons. If you are going for taxable forgiveness, you're going to need a brokerage account to put some money away so that you can write the IRS a check for that tax liability in 20 or 25 years. And if you're not going for taxable forgiveness, but you also, you know, you're able to do the $19,500 into a pre-tax account, you're able to do the $6,000 into a Roth account, and you've still got money left over, this is going to be the best place to put it. And you're likely going to be in a situation where you're thinking about retiring early. If I retire before age 59 and a half, I'm probably going to need to use my brokerage account so that I'm not incurring any penalties on the money that's in my retirement accounts. So there's a lot of strategy that goes into these different things. And believe it or not, I'm still not done talking about the Roth. The other thing that happens all the time during consultations is we learn that people are ineligible to contribute to a Roth IRA, even though they are actually doing so. Like I said, they've heard it from a friend. It's the cool thing to do. It's pretty easy to set up, but you don't know all the rules around it. You can't contribute to a Roth IRA if you make too much money. What does too much money mean? Well, in 2021, the limit for singles is $140,000 per year. For married couples, it is $208,000 per year. And the thing that makes it a little bit complicated is no one's going to stop you if you just go ahead and shove some money in there. But you will be in trouble if the IRS figures out that you weren't supposed to be putting money here and you, in fact, did it anyway. That's where, you know, kind of the honor system and being audited comes into place. I'm sure there's someone that's listening right now who's, you know, realizing that they've kind of jacked some things up and didn't even know it. This is where I jump in and give a plug for all the accountants out there. And this is why they're so important, because these are things that sometimes the tax software doesn't pick up on. While DIY taxes, you know, may save you money, there may be things that you're missing out on from a tax perspective or making mistakes on from a tax perspective. I've probably had to tell people 3 or 4 times this year that they are, in fact, not supposed to be contributing to a Roth based on the amount that they're earning. Maybe they were previously earning less and now their income has jumped up and they just kept doing it, but they can no longer do what we call the normal Roth IRA. What do you mean, Lauren? What do you mean about the normal IRA, Roth IRA contributions? Well, there's this thing called backdoor Roths. I'm not going to jump into all the details because we just don't want to spend too much time here, even though I probably already spent too much time on the Roth. But the short story is you can put money first in a traditional IRA and then move it over to a Roth IRA if you are in one of these situations where you make too much money. Yet another thing you're going to have to be mindful of is if you have old IRAs, so old traditional IRAs or rollover IRAs, old 401ks that you left behind and then you decided to roll over into an account. Now you also are going to have a problem if you try to do this backdoor Roth strategy, because you're going to be subject to what we call the pro rata rules. Something else to look up if you're not familiar with that term. But basically, some of your money is going to have to be taxed if you have money put away on a pre-tax basis, even though it's sitting over in a traditional IRA or what you call a rollover IRA. If you're trying to do this Roth thing and the traditional thing at the same time, you can get all messed up. Like I said, not going too far down that rabbit hole. The main thing you want to know is that there are income limits to when you can contribute to a Roth. There is another way to be able to contribute to a Roth if you are beyond those limits, but you need to make sure that you know and understand that you're doing it right. And then the last thing I'll say about the Roth is the other people that should be thinking about whether or not they are making proper Roth contributions are those that are doing married filing separately. If you do married filing separately, you also need to do the same strategy, or what is sometimes referred to as that backdoor Roth strategy, for yourself if you want to contribute to the Roth. You can't just put money in the front door. One of the privileges that you lose by doing married filing separately is the ability to contribute to a Roth IRA in the quote unquote normal way. Another area that a tax software may fail you. My question for you is, why complicate life if you know you're not too sure about these things? Enlist the help of a professional, a tax professional. So that's an enrolled agent or a CPA. These are going to be people who have education and certifications that allow them to do taxes specifically. They don't just like decide they do taxes. They're not just using a tax software, but they have specific knowledge and education and have passed an exam to be able to call themselves an enrolled agent or a certified public accountant. They can also represent you in court should you get audited. A regular tax preparer is just going to sign your return, move on, and if, you know, you get audited, you're going to have to enlist the help of a professional anyway. So why not work with a professional who already has the expertise and would be able to represent you should something happen? And then it's going to reduce the likelihood that something is going to happen anyway, because nobody wants to be audited. No one wants to cheat on their taxes or do anything illegal or fraudulent for that matter. And while I'm talking married filing separately, if you'll allow me for just a second to go off on a little tangent, I see people all the time coming to us that are doing married filing separately because they feel they just don't want to mingle things with their spouse. For us at Student Loan Planner, we do often recommend people doing married filing separately. It's not a one size fits all. It is very specific to individual situations, but it can be financially advantageous to do married filing separately depending on what your student loan situation is. However, like I said, I get a lot of people that are coming and they're already doing married filing separately. I'd say if you think your spouse is a crook or you just want to keep things separate, if you've experienced some sort of trauma growing up with other people that got divorced or you've been previously divorced and you just want to keep things separate from a tax perspective, then you probably need to dive deeper into your overall relationship situation. Part of my story is that I had very negative money emotion. coming into the financial industry and initially getting started, because I had so many things go wrong in my financial life before I decided to get educated about it. And it did leave me very uneasy and not really wanting to be open. But I realize now that it is very important to be transparent with your finances, especially when you have a partner or a spouse. When we all know better, we can do better. And that actually married filing separately doesn't really separate your finances. There's so many decisions that you all are making together as you go through life. And that when you take on a significant other, you know, you're truly better together. So I know I digress. I've gone off on a little tangent, but think about figuring out how to work with that person that is supposed to be your teammate in the financial situation, because simply saying, hey, I'm just going to do my financial thing over here and you do yours over there, seldom turns out to be a recipe for success. Another FAQ, let's keep it moving. What happens to my current retirement plan if I leave my employer? So we've kind of alluded to this already. I talked about the rollover IRA. You can either leave an old 401k or 403b, whatever your retirement plan is, at that employer, or you can take it on to the next employer. Most new employers are going to allow you to roll it into that employer. That's the most simple way to go about things, is take it from the old place, put it in the new place, don't have a lot of extra accounts or things that you have to manage, but you can do what we call a rollover IRA. So what happens is you leave the employer, you open a rollover IRA, you put it there, you're going to have to manage it, know what to invest in, and keep up on those things. So once again, that's another level of complexity that you're adding to your life. You could use one of those robo-advisors to keep it easy. And it's also going to complicate your ability to do backdoor Roths if you are a candidate for backdoor Roths. So rollover IRA or roll it into your new retirement account are your options for all those little old ones. As young professionals, you know, we've bounced around maybe to two or three different jobs and we just keep leaving money behind. You don't want to leave that money behind and not be sure what it's invested in at those various employers. You want to make sure you can keep track of those things, that you don't forget about them, and that you're making sure that all of your dollars are accounted for. I got just a couple more FAQs for you. This one is, how much should I be saving in my emergency fund? And as with everything, the answer is, it depends. What I like to recommend is that you save 3 times your take-home pay as a minimum emergency fund. That might be slightly different than what you read online. So you went on to good old-fashioned Google and they say 3 to 6 times your expenses. Well, what I found is that people kind of fudge their expenses, like, oh, my expenses are really low. This doesn't count. This doesn't count. This doesn't count. And they try to save 3 times their expenses and then poop hits the fan and they don't have enough to really cover 3 months of what's going on in their life if there's some sort of catastrophe. And with the pandemic having just passed, I think now more than ever, people are really looking at getting their emergency fund, what the value of that is, having good savings, sitting around doing nothing, and how that can just be helpful in light of not knowing what's coming around the corner. So why do I say 3 times your take-home pay? It makes it nice and easy to calculate. What are you bringing home? Multiply that times 3. So 10 grand times 3, $30,000. That's your emergency fund. If that's what your earnings look like, the first thing you might be saying, like, wow, you want me to have $30,000 sitting in cash, Lauren? That's crazy. Well, it's not crazy if some sort of catastrophe happens and that money needs to spring into action. The reason it feels crazy, especially if you're coming from a place of beginning financial stability or fresh out of school where you've been making $1,000 a month work, and now you're saying, like, Lauren, you want more than I had in a whole year sitting in a savings account? Well, your earnings is an increase. So if in my example, you're earning 10 grand a month, then you're in a great place. But it's hard for us sometimes to have that mindset shift to realize that that is not, in fact, a lot of money. It's just 3 months of what I bring home, a quarter of the year. And that could be really, really important should I be out of work or something like a global shutdown happens. The other thing I'll say is that 3 times is the minimum. 3 to 6 months is, like I said, kind of the general recommendation. And I'd say think about the risk that's associated with your work. Is there a lot of volatility? Does your income fluctuate on a month-to-month basis? Do you have children? Do you have a spouse with additional income? All of these things are going to play into how much risk you can take on or how much risk you should not take on. And the more risky those things are, you have a lot of volatility in your income. You have other people counting on you. You have someone else that could step in and their income could be good, even if you lost your income. That'll help you decide whether you need to be closer to the 6 month range. And then it's also a matter of comfort level. If you want to be more comfortable that we've got a longer runway, then you should definitely make sure that you have a bigger buffer and go toward that 6 month. In light of the pandemic, I've seen a lot of people go toward a whole 1 year emergency fund. Like I said, once again, it's all going to be a matter of your risk tolerance and then the other factors that influence your financial life. Okay, next one is best tool for budgeting. Answer for this one is whatever works best for you. What I like to use is what we call you need a budget. I think I've alluded to a little bit earlier in the podcast that I was financially illiterate, not 10 years ago now, I guess. Yeah, my journey started kind of 2012-ish, if you will, and really diving deep into becoming a certified financial planner and starting that journey to learning on my own. One of the things I discovered along the way was you need a budget because I had no real grasp on things. I had no idea what was coming in, what was going out, where it was going, how much I should be saving. I just didn't have a clear understanding like so many people. And budgeting, I think it's a bad rap. It's like the big bad B word. But if you, in fact, don't have any clue around your spending, you're going to find it very hard to save. And we get so caught up in the moment that we don't invest a lot of time in this area, but it's important that we do. With you need a budget, you're going to need to invest some time in getting to understand the software. And I think that's going to be with any of these electronic softwares that you use. But that investment of time is going to be able to save you money. So if you don't have a budget, go get one. All right, just one more FAQ for you. This last one says, I'm getting ready to have a baby and considering life insurance. Do you have any suggestions? Once again, we're not giving out financial advice. This is just generic, but what we generally recommend is that you go get some term life insurance. It's going to be a lot cheaper. Let's say you need $1 million of life insurance, and that term policy is going to cost you $50 a month for 30 years, whereas a whole life or variable annuity or something else is going to cost you $500 a month. Well, the difference between that 50 and that 500, $450, I'd much rather be putting that into an investment account, my retirement account, saving that up and making sure that I'm properly insured. Should I pass away, to make sure that baby is taken care of or the mortgage is taken care of or, you know, the various things for my family. And then building some wealth so that 30 years from now, ideally, I won't need that life insurance because I will have created wealth for myself. I would say, you know, to this question, though, the thing that we all need to be thinking about is estate planning. So often I hear estate planning is not for me. I don't have a bunch of wealth. I'm not going to be subject to the estate planning taxes. That's not really what estate planning is. Estate planning is planning for the things that you can't see in the same way that life insurance, car insurance, health insurance are. Some sort of catastrophic event comes along and these things kick into place so that the catastrophe can be best managed. That's what estate planning documents do for you. When I'm talking about estate planning documents, I'm thinking of things like healthcare directive, financial directives, wills, trust. All of those are documents that can spring into action, like I said, either if you're incapacitated or if you kick the bucket. So imagine, you know, being in a car accident or having some sort of health issue where you're not able to pay your bills, you're not able to make decisions on your own, but you're going to live. You're going to recover. You're going to make a full recovery and life is going to go back to normal at some point. Who's going to pick up the dog and take care of them over that time period if you're single? Who's going to, you know, take care of the kids in the short term? Maybe there's a long-term person that you've asked about taking care of your kids, but if you're out on a date and this car accident happens, who's going to pick them up from the sitter and look after them until the long-term person can fly into town? Those are the issues that are estate planning. And then for my real estate investors, we get lots and lots of people who want to buy rental property or already have purchased rental property that do consultations with us. Is your real estate in the proper structure? You know, maybe it needs to be in an LLC to limit your liability. That is a part of estate planning. That's something that a lawyer sets up for you to make sure that you're good to go should somebody, you know, fall down and hurt themselves on your property. But then also, like you said, when we get back to talking about death or disability or incapacity, who's going to look after that property? Who do you want to have those properties? A lot of people are having conversations about creating generational wealth and generational wealth transfers. These are the things that need to be in place if there's someone coming into your life. So if a new baby or a spouse are coming into play, you want to have these documents in place. I'd say the other thing that's important is domestic partnerships are becoming a lot more normal. People are choosing not to get married, but are doing life together. You want to make sure that you have documents in place that express your wishes about what you want them to have or not have. And then last but not least, as we're thinking about all of this is, you know, life insurance, estate planning, et cetera, is funeral costs. I think we've all seen a situation where someone had a GoFundMe page or emails were sent out asking if people could chip in, because death generally happens unexpectedly. You don't have a lot of time to plan in advance for it, but the best time to plan in advance for it is when you are completely healthy. I have covered a lot today. And as we wrap up with the FAQs, I hope you found some of them helpful. There's some helpful tips and hints to get you going on the right track as it pertains to organizing your finances. I just like to say that mindset is important. The biggest thing you can do for yourself, if you're having a hard time financially right now, you're struggling, you're feeling overwhelmed with your student loan debt or your regular monthly bills, is to change the way that you think about money. The hardest calls for me are when people book and expect us to have a magic wand to make it all go away. And they're sometimes just not in a mental space to be able to receive the information. They feel overwhelmed, they feel desperate, but also just not ready to say that I can, in fact, take control over my situation, that I do have many choices. These choices may require me to get out of my comfort zone, but I can, in fact, change my financial trajectory. What does it look like to cut expenses? Is it selling a house? Is it moving into an apartment for a year? Having a roommate? People are like, no way, no how. Oh, I can't do those things. But if you're in a real tough financial situation, you're going to have to make some big changes in order to be able to have that financial success sooner rather than later. Challenge yourself to say, what if I made this change for 365 days and it was going to give me 3,650 days of joy and freedom? I'm not saying it's easy to be strapped with six-figure student loan debt. It's not awesome by any means, but it's all about the way that you think about it. It's not 100% bad. Don't give it that much power over you. Think about the things that are awesome about the opportunities you've had because of your student loans. Better earning potential, the time that you had at that school, the people that you met, maybe even your spouse. I challenge you to make a list of at least five things that are wonderful about your student loan debt to help you shift into a mindset that's going to help you feel better and take action toward creating a plan so that you can kick this debt's butt. As I wrap up, I'm thinking of someone who has done just that. We have an avid listener named Melissa, who I had the privilege of doing a consultation with and was a pure joy to work with. The reason I'm shouting out Melissa is because she's a great example of taking control of your finances. She's done tons of research. She's taken action. She's aligned her spending with her values. She spent the money on the consultation to get that expert advice, but in a teach me how to fish sort of way. She took the information that I shared with her and her own knowledge from the research that she done and helped her mother to get a plan ready for her retirement. So while I like to think that everybody needs a financial planner, you can be self-taught and empowered by resources just like this podcast to organize your financial life. You may love your financial planner, and I love being a financial planner, but ultimately we are facilitators of information. You have to be the one that decides to take action on your finances. If you are overwhelmed, know that you are not alone, but deciding to do something about it is an important factor in changing your mindset and will be a key indicator of your financial success. This work has given me so much joy. I'm so glad that I reached out to Travis randomly to be on my podcast back in 2018. And as I wrap up, my financial company, Worth Winning, is taking off. So I will be moving to just Thursday starting in August. I do all debt ranges. So if you land on my calendar on a Thursday, I look forward to being able to serve you. You can find our scheduling link, tons of great blogs. And now we also got information on YouTube as well. All you've got to do is go to studentloanplanner.com. With that, we're going to wrap it up for today. So ciao for now. I hope you enjoyed the solo episode with consultant Lauren Williams. Take care.